XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about the impact of the Day Without Immigrants protest and what this may mean for the future of the immigration debate. My guests are Christy Cunningham, law professor and director of the Education Rights Center at the Howard University School of Law, and Nicole Paul, entrepreneur and founder of High Definition Hair. She has employed immigrants for more than a decade. Lines are open. Give us a call. We will get to you. Please keep trying at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Nicole, before the break, you wanted to make a point. Please go right ahead.
Yes, we are a country of immigrants. I'm a child of an immigrant. My mother came over here, I think, in the mid-60s, I think 64, 65.
From where?
Oh, Trinidad and Tobago.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what I say to my employees is this, who are immigrants, there has to be some balance. There has to be, we have to have, we're a sovereign nation, and I don't think the border should be open. I speak to them in a sense of, look, I can literally get people to work for me for literally half of what you guys make. If there were like 20 people applying for the same job, I can hire those, you know, those people willing to work for half and save my company a lot of money. And the point that I'm making is that many people coming into this country without getting in line can lead to wage suppression. And I tell them that. And when I break it down to them, they kind of understand. And I feel like with a lot of the immigrants coming in and feeling like now they can't go to the stores or they can't they don't want to drive. They don't even want to come out the house. They don't want to go check in with probation officers and such. They feel like, you know, like this whole thing with Trump, you know, cracking down with the raids and stuff, they feel like it's unfair. And I tell them, you know, look, there has to be balance. We can't have open borders. We have to check with people coming in. I tell them about human trafficking. There's women, you know, locked up in Langley Park and Columbia Heights, supposedly, you know, on their backs trying to pay off their coyotes who changed the price on them, smuggling them across. I've had employees who've worked for me for over 10 years, and some of them came with coyotes. Mm-hmm. And they said that sometimes the price gets swapped out on them when they get here. They think it's $3,500 or $5,500. It ends up being $7,500 and $8,500. And some of them are put to work it off, however they can work it off. And I tell them that these things are dangerous and people should get in line, you know, so things are safer. So my point, I'm just making a point, is if there is no line for people to get in to come to this country, what's the point of having a line altogether?
And but it is complicated, though, because while certainly, you know, one could argue that the lion's share of people who have been impacted by this, the immigration ban that the Trump administration attempted to exercise were people of a Muslim descent, for example, as we saw in, you know, in the airports. But then also we saw brown people with these ICE raids also being impacted. And so certainly we've been talking about immigration reform in this country since before there was a Trump campaign. We talked a lot about that during the Obama administration. There was a lot of discussion about that during the Bush administration. It is a complicated thing, Christy.
It is a very complicated thing. And, you know, it's interesting to talk about balance. And it seems, and I, with all due respect, it seems that people want to talk about balance when it comes to the poorest and the most disenfranchised having to negotiate their position and their rights. You know, balance wouldn't have, I think news came out from Oxfam recently that the eight rich,
Oxfam,
thank you, recently that the eight richest people in the world own as much as the bottom 50% of the world. So if you want to talk about balance, I think you start talking about balance a little bit higher up.
But that's also out of the scope of what we're talking
about. No, let me explain. Let me explain how that's within the scope of how we're talking about. Well, this past summer, I'm from Texas, and I go home a few times a year. But this past summer when I went home, I volunteered with the CARA Pro Bono Project, who was working at the South Texas Family Residential Center, which is a detention center. It's essentially a prison for women and their children. And when I say children, I mean children. I mean like babies. Some of them couldn't walk, were in this prison. And these women were coming up escaping. Some of them had no food. Some of them were literally fleeing. One woman, for example, fled because her sisters, she told a story of her sister's husband who had killed their 2-year-old daughter. She was a victim of domestic violence, and I won't describe how the death happened. And so then her husband, who was also beating her, said, well, I'm going to do to our child the same thing that your sister's husband did to her child.
But let me stop you, because I want to make sure that I get back to the phone calls, but I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but, you know, to Nicole's point, whether someone is coming in just because they want to be here, the circumstances that they're leaving behind are just fair and they want greater, or they're coming from a tragic, horrific situation, should there be some kind of line like Nicole was talking about? Should there be some kind of process?
Okay, so, you know, I can't say that I favor a completely open border as well. I'm just going to say I don't know. But what I am saying is that if we're going to start talking about process and putting limitation, then I think that we should start thinking about putting limitations on the excesses of maybe people and policies in this country. Why is it that the United States, what I'm trying to say is I think the Trump administration is promoting a culture of greed. Like, we have way more than most people in most parts of the world. And so the borders and the wall is so that we can keep all of the things that we have here and keep everybody out. So
it's not keeping everyone out.
Okay, making them get in line. So whether they are starved while they're standing in line, whether they get killed by gangs that we facilitated creating in their country while they're standing in line, whether or not their children die while they're standing in line, you know, that's not our problem, because we're going to let them in one or two or three at a time. And if there's too many of them in here, we're going to kick them out because they're going to take our stuff.
But the other side of that argument is everyone can claim that they're coming from a bad place, like they need asylum. You know what I mean? Unless we do background checks on everyone, everyone could make that same claim.
So here's the problem.
Hold on. Before we get to that, I've got to take some phone calls. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Day Without Immigrants protest and what it means for the future of the immigration debate. Let me go to Richard. Richard, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Richard. What's on your mind?
How you doing?
I'd just
like to say a few things. I'd like to say, first and foremost, the country that we live in America, the problem here is accountability. And unfortunately, people who do have their papers, who have lived in America for 2 years and years, once you commit a crime, you're locked up. You get locked up, you get processed. For the life of me, I don't understand how people make exceptions for somebody who runs around with no papers. I don't care how many years you've been here. The number one thing is you don't have papers. Automatically, your excuse is inexcusable, and you should be processed just like anybody else. I have friends who've committed crimes and got locked up, and you got people that come here with no papers, and they're making a song and a dance. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't. Everybody should be under one umbrella. You know, it's sad that things happen, but when you make that choice and you come here, no matter if it was life or death, 15 years you could be here. When that day comes, if you get caught, you have nothing to cry about because you know what you've done. You should have no reason.
Richard, thank you for your point. Briefly, go right ahead.
No, I would just say, well, it would be a shame if slaves that were escaping from the South were that argument were used against them. So they were breaking the law. It was the law that they could be enslaved. They were owned. They were somebody's property. And so when they fled out of slavery, they didn't have any papers.
So, but hold on. Let's keep it here in 2017. because then I think we get too far down in the weeds. But and I think the difficult conversation is that that Richard, as I'm assuming, was born here in the United States, and that we even as Black people have a tendency to speak from the privilege of native-born citizenship. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that's one of the things that makes this a very complicated thing, which is, you know, one of the things that one of the earlier callers kind of pulled it together, where he said that, you know, the way that some new immigrants and maybe even some of the illegal immigrants are treated now is akin to the way that Black folks were treated, in those same kinds of jobs, prior to the civil rights movement. And so I think that may give us pause. But nevertheless, Richard, thank you for your phone call. Let me go to Rufus. Rufus calling from D.C. What's on your mind?
Yes. I'm a Washingtonian and born.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with both the youngest, but I agree with the lawyer. But, see, you have to take in consideration, Harold, and the two young ladies. When Trump came in and he started doing his debate, the first thing he wanted to bring back was law and order. Well, in New York, law and order was considered unconstitutional, and they fought against it and everything. And he figured if he couldn't get law and order the way he wanted to, because he's targeting, like I said, immigrants, but he's targeting a large set of people that people don't realize, he's talking. Despite his claims about who he has as friends in Atlanta, he's still targeting Afro-Americans. He's targeting Hispanics. He's targeting Muslims. And he's doing, but we go back to, like the lawyer said, that she didn't say it, but I could say racial profiling. You cannot say that, and that's what he's doing. That's why he's doing a lot of this ICE raids and trying to form a bill, because he wants to bring back his law and order.
Mm. Okay.
To the United States. That's why we're having all this rage. Mm.
Rufus, thank you so much. And I think one of the points that he makes, and again, if I can kind of bring it to a head, I think what Rufus is really talking about is the criminalization of people of color. Because when you talk about during early in the campaign, when Donald Trump was talking about, Mexicans and people coming up. Okay, mm-hmm. and he was calling them murderers and rapists and the like. And then, as we saw just recently with the executive order with the seven mostly Muslim countries, again, people of color or religious minorities being criminalized. And one could argue, and Nicole, I'll let you make your point, is that when in Canada a week or so ago, when a white Canadian killed Muslims at a mosque, there were no tweets from the president. Okay.
No
mention of it at all. And so one could argue, as Christy said, that this doesn't appear on the surface and maybe even deep down, like the criminalization of people of color. But go ahead, make your point.
All I'm saying is that everyone can cry. Everyone can cry that they have tragic circumstances, and people will take advantage of that. And I don't want to go into each and everybody's stories that work for me, but most of them came across the La Frontera, the desert, okay? And they seen a lot. I don't want to go into every single detail, but the point being is that people will take advantage of us establishing this criteria of anyone that's seeking asylum, whether it's political or domestic or whatever the case may be, they're free to come in, then everyone should just say the same thing. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that you're not stopping everyone from using that criteria to seek, refuge in this country. when you cry slavery or domestic abuse or whatever the case may be. All I'm saying is my parents came over here and they did it legally. And I'm saying, and I tell them that if we just open my employees, if we just open up the borders to anybody and everybody that just want to come over here, then there will be employers will have a big supply that would decrease our demand and we can just pay less to who we want to employ. And people can be abused as well. Like there's girls washing, wiping down cars for like $3.25 an hour in like 30 degree weather. You know, you can have more of that stuff happening in this country if you just open up the borders to everyone.
I need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Tony in Columbia and Justin calling from Oklahoma. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about the Day Without Immigrants protest and what it means for America. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, what up, world?
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the impact of the Day Without Immigrants protest and what this may mean for the future of the immigration debate. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tony calling from... Tony, are you there? Give me a call back if you can. Let's go to Justin calling from Oklahoma. Justin, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today? I just wanted to make a comment on the lady who was attributing slavery to the immigration. First of all, I draw a huge distinction between being torn from your country and trying to escape something as horrible as slavery and escaping your country. I don't think it's comparable at all. And also, one thing I want everybody to think about is with the flood of illegal immigration that we have coming into this country every year, if only 2-3% of those people had terrorist intentions, think about how that could possibly impact our country. I want people to think about those things. As a Trump supporter from Oklahoma, I support people seeking better lives, but there's also a lot of people who are doing it the right way. And that's I want you guys to think about that. That's all I really have to say.
Okay. Justin, thank you so much.
So the comparison that I was making is that during slavery, people were held in extreme violence and with courage, and sometimes for the betterment of their children, they would flee. And that is exactly what's happening in many cases in Central America, that people are literally fleeing because they fear that they will be killed the next day, or because they're afraid that their daughter will be trafficked, or because they're afraid... Because the gangs came to their door yesterday and said, if you don't give me your son, we will kill him. So they are fleeing the same way the slaves did. And when they get to our door, we close it. Now, and I'm just saying, what would it have been like? Would we want to have been in the position of someone who sees a slave escaping slavery and they knock on your door and you close the door?
But like I said, if that was the criteria established to gain an entrance into this country, everyone would use that. So we can't. It's horrible. You know, it's tragic that people are in those circumstances, but we can't use that as criteria.
So the thing that I think it's somewhat unique about Central America, and that's the situation that I'm most familiar with, is that. The situation in Central America is in part due to U.S. policy. When the U.S. had the previous immigration reform, gang members, primarily in L.A., were deported into countries like El Salvador. And so the MS-13 and D-18 were exported from the U.S. back to Central America. They took root in Central America and now are have formed, you know, systems that are oppressing the people there. So it's not just that people are fleeing hardship. They're fleeing hardship that the U.S. had a role in creating. And so I think that the U.S., you know, needs to take a serious look at slamming the door in those people's face.
So then what about, so if we, you know, turn the lens around across the Atlantic and start talking about folks who are trying to escape war from, you know, in Syria. Is the criteria different?
You know, that's an excellent question. I'm not going to try to say that I can solve every problem. Mm-hmm. Syria is a very, very complex situation. I think what makes America great.
Did you say that?
I said no. That was the beginning of a sentence. don't shot me off at the comma. Let me put it this way. I would back screech on that one. I think what makes people great, part of what makes people great, is a spirit of compassion. And I don't think just because you have somebody somewhere in some office who appears to lack compassion that the rest of us have to lack compassion. So if you see somebody who is in desperate need, then if you can help them, help them. And if you can't help all of them, help the ones that you can. And if there's a concern, there's the other thing. Is there a concern that, so we put this this terrorist label on anybody who's running from a hard situation, and we're afraid that out of the thousands, maybe one is going to be bad. Well, you know, I agree with the caller that there are consequences, but I think that we've been sold a bag of goods if we start thinking of whole classes of people as being potential terrorists. You know,
but let me ask you this, Nicole, because as you said, you're a businesswoman, but I would argue for you, and tell me if I'm wrong, that not every one of your hires is completely with a business sense in mind, particularly as it relates to the immigrants. There may indeed be some compassion in your hiring practices. Like you said, you've been hiring, you know, immigrants for 10 years. That's not just, you're not just, you know, saying that. I mean, and maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, is there compassion when, you know, making, you know, these business decisions as it relates to the immigrants that you do employ?
Well, I like them because they are hard workers. They're dependent. I could depend on them. They're dependable.
Yeah. Thanks. You're the dependent one. Yeah. You're depending on them. But go ahead.
They're dependable. They're hard workers. They've been great for me. And I'll admit, because they're Hispanic, I can, you know, they're willing to work for a lower wage. I'm just going to say it. For me to employ Americans to do the same type of work, we build wigs from scratch for specific people. Wig construction, theatrical wig construction. We do it for movies, films, celebrities, cancer patients, what have you. It's very tedious work. And like they were telling me yesterday and Tuesday, you know, they're going to see what it feels like to not have us to do, you know, their jobs, to take care of their kids, to serve, you know, to clean their bathrooms, what have you and have you. But I'm like, I've heard some Black folks complain that, you know, Hispanics are taking all the jobs. There's no jobs, you know, basically blue collar jobs. I'm like, if you went to school, you know, maybe you can, the job field will be more open for you. But, you know, I've heard, you know, from all walks of life that, you know, Hispanics take up all the jobs. And that's what I'm saying. It's like if they left this country, hypothetically speaking, and there were only, you know, Blacks and whites or what have you to do the work, everything would cost more around here. You know what I mean? Like Black people, you know, doing housekeeping or something, you may have to pay them 20 an hour. As opposed to 14 an hour.
You know what? You know what today reminds me of? It reminds me of the first Million Man March. And the reason I say that is because in 1995, when it happened, I was in Columbus, Ohio. I was a TV news reporter. And Columbus, Ohio, the demographics are very, very different than they are here. But, you know, African-American men in Columbus, Ohio still did some of the menial jobs, but a lot of them drove the buses, and they worked in the transportation industry, whether it's city buses, school buses. Mm-hmm. In October of 1995, the city of Columbus, many of their city offices and even some of the bus routes had to shut down. And there was a message that was delivered at that point. The question about this is, was it impactful today? And what is the long-term effect of this day without immigrants? Your thoughts about that real quick, Christy.
Yeah, so real quick, one thought I had was kind of in listening to you talk, Nicole, which is that some of your workers were saying they're gonna see what it's like without us. And, you know, I'm a little ambivalent. On the one, that's the strength in the action. On the other, it sets up an us-them split, mm-hmm. right? And I think that one of the dangerous things of kind of the culture and what's in the air right now is division.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were speaking earlier that that immigrants or some people, brown people, are taking black people's job. That's what you have heard some people say, mm-hmm. that, oh, they're taking our jobs. You know, why? It's like we're groups of people fighting over crumbs. And why are we fighting over crumbs when we know that there's like a banquet being eaten by two or three people, and then 1,000 of us are down here fighting over some crumbs? I think we lose if we allow the rhetoric to divide us. There's no we're not divided. We're down here together.
It's not just rhetoric, though. It's reality. It's not for them. You know what I mean? Like when they're looking for jobs, maybe they didn't graduate college, and maybe they're a barista, or maybe they're good at waitressing or bussing tables or something. They feel like, you know, there's no jobs available, and what jobs are available, they pay little because there's always someone willing to do it for little pay.
Yeah, but this is really kind of an old trick, you know. Poor white workers were always pitted or against black workers, or black strike breakers were brought in to kind of be set up against poor white workers. This is an old trick, and the trick is still being played. I think we need to think smarter.
I'm going to have to leave it there. Obviously, this is, at least for us, one of the beginnings of a conversation that will go on as we continue to watch this process play out. I want to thank both of you, Christy Cunningham and Nicole Paul, for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.